had a cinnamon swirl.
Yeah, cinnamon swirls are great.
Do you like a cinnamon
yes.
swirl?
Yes. They smell so good when they're being made, when they're being baked.
And they taste so nice. But they are the downside. You know, I'm having a little bit of time off from work, back on the school run, sorting the boys out, getting ready to get back into it. That's the downside. Yesterday, I don't know if this is normal, I met a couple of friends. Yes, I worked this out. This is awful. I went to, throughout the course of the day, between 11 and 3, something, went to 4 different coffee shops. And I didn't have 4 cinnamon swirls. That'd be wrong. But you just go to a coffee shop, then you have to eat something.
Yeah.
So you maybe have a bit of cake or something. Yeah. And I have like a green tea or whatever. But this is not a healthy existence. And as it's getting colder, you sort of, this is the downside to not working. It's the meeting friends for, I don't want to put you off because I know you were going to come down with baby Rog, and we can still do that, but I think we're going to have to go for a run. Is Rog up for that?
Okay, I've got a running buggy for him, so he can,
is he?
Cause he likes that.
I can't. I mean, you know, I'm eating a lot of cakes and things, catching up with people, which is lovely, but it's a slippery slope.
Oh, it's always good to catch up over tea and cake. Tea and biscuits is another option.
You're not giving me a good option, so I'm having to run further every morning to compensate for what's going to happen later in the day.
That's
so
how it works, though, isn't it?
I've already had one of those today because I went for a nice walk with a friend, and she said, why don't we end at this? It's a Danish bakery that sounds like Bang & Olufsen, but that's a stereo. Don't they make stereos or something?
It's general sort of technical music, audio things.
So it's not that, but it sounds like that. And they make a very good cinnamon swirl. So I just had to, I've got to sort myself out. So if you and baby Rog want to come and visit, bring the running buggy and we're off.
Okay? Great. We just go and keep going until we've earned ourselves, ourselves a cinnamon swirl.
And I mean, then it just sort of negates everything we've just done. And now you're going to be like, oh, you know, I was going to come visit. I'm busy. I can't. I'm just going to keep putting it off. tennis. We always say this, but I did a Roger Federer show for 5 Live recently, all about Roger Federer with Russell Fuller. And we spoke to Kevin Anderson, who is lovely. Isn't he lovely, Kevin?
So
Anderson?
Nice.
So lovely. And he was just sorting out his daughter, Kira, before he came. Oh, just such a lovely man. We had a lot of different voices in there. There was Sue Barker in there. And one of the main voices on the hour with Russell and myself was Chris Clary from the New York Times. And we started off by saying, I started by saying something we talk about, like tennis is the gift that keeps on giving. I just want a couple of weeks without a gift. You know?
Yeah.
I feel, it's been quite full on, hasn't it?
Yes.
Like if you're a really big legendary player, don't retire. I don't know. Don't retire in 2022. We've done it. We've had 2 back to back.
Yeah.
I think we're all kind of, you know, even Chris was saying, I think he was getting to the Monday, then he was having a little bit of downtime. But it's wonderful on one hand, but it's nonstop. And I'm just like, can it just be a little bit quieter?
I've said this before. I mean, tennis just has a way of, there's always a news story, especially the past, I don't know, what, maybe 2-3 years, maybe longer than that.
Yeah.
It's just relentless because we do have such big superstars, and it means that, you know, they make any sort of announcement, it's big news. And it is an extraordinary thing. And I still try and understand how tennis or individuals in the sport can cut through. It doesn't necessarily translate into people playing tennis or necessarily watching tennis. It's relentless. Every month feels like there's something pretty big.
But then saying that, I've just said it's relentless. Yeah, I started the podcast talking about cinnamon swirl, which would tell the listener that maybe there isn't this bursting piece of news that we just had to get out at the very beginning.
It's not breaking news. No, there's no breaking news now. Everybody's sort of up to speed. It's been a slightly quieter week. We watched the end of Laver Cup. And it just generally is quieter post US Open, especially, you know, the calendar's different now as well. We don't have the big Chinese tournaments that we had on the WTA tour. And we've had Davis Cup, Laver Cup. So the cups are done. And then now
we needed Team World For this is a very dramatic statement. I don't think I mean it this dramatically for the survival of the Laver Cup, but you know, keep it around that. Team World needed to win.
Well, they did, but I still maintain this, even though we know the result and we know that they won, in that they had no chance of winning. So I don't really understand how we're here, because they had no chance of winning. They beat a team with the big four in it. They beat a team with Djokovic,
the best player in the world,
and Nadal, the second best player in the world.
No, but come on. We had Andy Murray, and we love Andy Murray and everything, but it's not the Andy Murray of the big 4 days. Yeah. We had Roger Federer, who I think we saw how he played, and it was so wonderful that was even tough for him to do that, and the knees not there. Nadal's had his problems through the year. So, yes, I know it was the big... And Djokovic ended up saying there were wrist problems. I know he went to Tel Aviv, but it wasn't the big four?
Yeah, it was, but it wasn't. Maybe on paper it looked silly, but it still felt like an almighty challenge for Team World, whose best player was Francis Tiafoe. It's just baffling. Like, they managed to win. But it's sort of the nature of the way that they've done the scoring as well, that, you know, points... matches are worth many more points in the last day than they are on others and that sort of thing. But yeah, it was fun. It was difficult because it was the Roger Federer show. It was all about him playing with Rafa, and it was all about the interactions between Rafa, Novak and Federer, I think particularly. Lots of people very interested in that. And yeah, for the most part, pretty much until going into the last match, we realised that Team World could win. No one paid attention to Team World at all. Forgot they're even there. I feel so bad. But for good reason, because it was the Roger Federer show. But yeah, and then suddenly it was, oh, wow, they could actually win this. And there you go. Then they did.
I was just actually looking up results from... I think in terms of the future, I think it was good for Team World to win, because I think it could have got to the point where maybe people wouldn't have wanted to join Team World. They think we're just going to get beaten in terms of people going to watch it. I know we've talked about it being an exhibition, but I think it needs to be competitive. I think they needed that win to give them a bit of hope, because they were probably like us. But I was looking at the results. One person not to be worried about is Stefanos Tsitsipas. Where's Tsitsipas? So he lost to Tiafoe. Are you Tiafoe or Tiafoe? Before we continue.
Well, I don't know. I always was Tiafoe, but then I feel like more people say Tiafoe than they say anything else, so I'm going with that now. Okay. I'm flexible.
Yeah, I'm flexible. I was always Tiafoe, but I'm exactly like you. So Tiafoe came through and beat Tsitsipas. I know Tsitsipas had a very convincing win against Diego Schwartzman. Are we concerned that Tsitsipas is standing still a little and people are overtaking him, or is that just normal in the life cycle of tennis?
It's normal. There's no reason to be concerned, but he absolutely is drifting a bit. And he feels like, you know, a little down on confidence. I mean, in comparison, remember how well he played that clay court season where he reached the final of the French Open. And, you know, he managed to defend his title in Monte Carlo, but I thought it was quite interesting because... Oh, I'm digging into the stats that I did at Monte Carlo, but I'm pretty sure that Monte Carlo is the only Masters event that he's won. So he won it in 2020, and then he defended his title he won it in 2021 and then defended it in 2022, but he hadn't won a Masters in between then. So that was sort of a bit bizarre. He has been in the final of a slam. Look, Casper Ruud's won a Masters now after being in... Now he's been in two finals of slams. And, you know, it's just faded a little bit for Tsitsipas, hasn't it? He's still there. He's still thereabouts. He's always a threat because you never know when he's going to get his game together and go on a run. But it just feels like mentally you're not going to back him against big players in big matches.
Yeah, I think it's exactly that, and I think it's interesting now as we get towards the end of this year, then move into next, how things shuffle about. And I think we can put Tiafoe in that conversation of how he's gonna, you know, beats Nadal, reaches his first Grand Slam semi-final, plays and wins in Federer's final match that doubles with Jack Sock, helps Team World to win. I mean, these are really good times for Francis Tiafoe. I know he's someone that we've talked about for a long time, and he said it was almost good where the ranking went down and the pressure was off him. But it's going to be really interesting to see where he can take this next. You know, but coming back to confidence, because he at the moment's got all the confidence in the world.
Oh, it was just so much fun watching him do what he did in New York. He just is so much fun. But what was great is that he just got on with business. I remember commentating on his matches and thinking, okay, when's he mentally going to go off a bit? When's he going to start throwing in these yep. silly decisions? When's that going to come and that's going to really turn the match around? And he just didn't do it. And you can't afford to do that against Nadal. It doesn't work. And he just didn't do it round after round after round. But he still was able to maintain his character. And that's always the balance, because it's something I've said a lot. When you try and rein in players, whether it's personality-wise, decision-making, aggression, whatever it might be, when you try and rein them in, sometimes they can go stale because they don't have that spark, that flair, the bit of them that makes them good. It's hard to control. It's an incredibly difficult job as a coach, and you've got to give huge credit to Wayne Ferreira, who's been working with him now for a number of years, because it's quite specialist. And I think there are a lot of coaches on tour that don't know how to do that. And then there are some that I think that specialise in that a little bit more. I think they're quite good at going, okay, right, you got all this stuff to use. Let's work out how we're going to use it. It's not about withdrawing it, it's about how you're going to use it. So what I loved more than anything about TFO is that he wasn't just getting on with business and just being a totally different person. He was still himself, but the tennis he was playing was much more professional, much more disciplined. He still was smiling with the crowd. He still had that relaxed personality. So that's really tough, because a lot of the time what comes with that relaxed personality is the loss of discipline. That's sort of how it works. It always tends to go hand in hand. So to find that balance, he was clearly having a whale of a time, but every shot, every decision was spot on of the very, very highest level. And we know that he's a phenomenal athlete. We know that he has huge amounts of power. He's got the shots. It was always about the mentality. So it is very exciting, but it's also hard to maintain that, because as much as he has developed that, it's not his natural being. It's not his natural character. When things get stressful, it's all very well when you're having a breakthrough run in New York and beating Nadal, but when things get stressful, when things get tight, when the pressure is on, is he going to revert back? Because that will be the pull. That will be the natural pull inside of him to go back. It's hard to maintain. And that's why, again, you know, we're talking about Federer and his game style and how it just doesn't make any sense, even just looking at physics, as to how he was able to be so consistent playing in that such high-risk game style. He made it seem like it wasn't high-risk at all. In the same way with his personality, there's lots of stories, and we all remember when he first was on the tour, he had quite a temper. He really had to get that under control and change his behaviour, but he managed to change his behaviour for the long term. As in, you could just guarantee that he was going to, of course, he's going to grumble a little bit and there's a few shouts here and there, but largely he was pretty unflappable and we didn't see that character again. It's another thing that is just so unattainable for everybody else. You know, you do see people get it together, but then it just falls away. You know, you can look at, say, someone like Garbiñe Muguruza. You know, once she gets on the right path and she is able to make the right decisions and have the confidence, you know, she's absolutely flying, but she can't maintain it for that long. So she's always going to slip back away again. It's just a period of time. So look, the likelihood is, as it is for a lot of players, that this will last for 6 months, 9 months, something like that. And then it might slide a little bit again. But you never know. Maybe this is it. This is the new Francis.
Just mentioned Roger Federer's temper. I mentioned that show I did recently, and one story Chris Clary remembered was from Roger Federer's junior days. There was a tournament he had lost, and while most of the boys were having their picnics with their family around the side of the court, he had to be dragged crying from under the chair umpire's chair because he was so distraught at what had happened. And the one story I found was his father. He was driving back from a junior tournament one day, and he was in the back of the car and he was going on and on about losing, and he just going on and on and on. His dad got to the point, and I don't think you could do this. Well, maybe I don't think you could do this today. Maybe you couldn't do it then. His dad was so annoyed, he stopped the car, He opened the door, he took Roger out, and he put his head in the snow to cool him down.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a bit much, isn't it?
Can you imagine driving along and there's some dad sort of putting his head, he said, I just wanted him to cool down. And when you look back, you know, at those stories, and as you say, how he managed to change it to become Zen. So he's gone from that, having his head put in the snow to cool him down, and he said he was embarrassed by his behaviour and what his parents had to witness, to being called Zen-like on court is... But that's a change you have to want to make as well, isn't it? I mean, that's a massive overhaul.
But it is also just quite a skill, I think, for anyone in life to change behaviour or their sort of character traits is incredibly difficult. And in times of stress, you always revert back to the thing you're trying to manage, the thing you're trying to control. And whether there are players on tour who have to deal and manage with anxiety, like Garbiñe Muguruza, like that's one example, or confidence, like a Diego Schwartzman, for example, very low on confidence, and all of a sudden, you know, that's gone away. Or we were talking about Grigor Dimitrov last week, or whether it's the anger and the frustration that we see with plenty of players, like Federer had. You can keep a lid on it for a time, but there has to be some sort of outlet. And if there isn't an outlet, then it tends to release when you're in the high pressure situation, which is on court with millions of people watching. So it can be difficult when that's happening, and you know it's happening as well. You know exactly what's happening, but you can't do anything about it. So another thing as to why it was just so phenomenal with watching Federer and what he achieved, because he just changed the rules so much. Like we were talking about the physics of his game, like it just, that no one else can play like that, no one can do it. You either do it like Grigor Dimitrov does, so high risk that you can't play consistently, you know, or you do what everybody else does and you don't do it because it's too stupid to do. So it's just another pretty impressive thing. And it is a trait of all of the top players. They're all very good at, you know, managing things. But we see even Djokovic, you know, every so often it slips out. It does. And he does revert, and he's got to sort of get a grip of it again and push forward. He does a very good job of keeping a lid on it, but it's not easy. It's not easy. I mean, think about last year when he was going for the Golden Slam, the ultimate pressure. And my word, did he disintegrate? Absolutely. The sort of person that you think, everyone talks about him, there's no weaknesses, there's nothing to get at, you can't break him down, he's just so solid. Every match, it's just a nightmare to play against. And he just completely disintegrated. And it was unbelievable to watch.
Wow.
You know, so, yeah, sure, Federer's had situations when he's been match points or championship points at Wimbledon and lost, and he's had difficult things to deal with, and who knows what happens behind the scenes afterwards. As I say, there needs to be an outlet somewhere. Who knows what goes on? But, yeah, just ridiculously impressive. We've launched into a Roger Federer pod, which we weren't planning to do.
I know, yeah, we weren't planning to.
We're supposed to be talking about Francis, poor Francis.
I did that Djokovic Zverev match at the Olympics, and wow, the pressure. And then at the US Open, and you see the tears as he sits at his chair. Oh, it's interesting because it gets you thinking about how people deal with pressure. I can't believe Nick Kyrgios's name didn't come up in that little chat there, but he's someone who is turning things around, is changing, does still revert back to it. Someone else is Alexander Bublik, who it feels... Recent, you must have seen it. Everyone's seen it. Have they all seen it?
Yeah.
The Mets. In the fight. Look, there is a time and a place for tweeners and underarm serves. But like, what? So it made me think, is that a pressure thing? Is that a fear of failing, of winning? What is that? What is in someone's mind during a final against Lorenzo Sonego? And actually that point, so he hit the ball with a handle of his racket. It led to Sonego getting a double break. Ultimately, but what is that pressure? What goes through someone's mind to do that?
I think in general it can be pressure. And when we talk about pressure, for anyone who's not experienced it, it's very similar to day to day. As in, you cannot think straight when you are really emotional, right? That goes for everybody in life. You can't think straight. True. You can't talk straight. You say things you don't mean. You make terrible decisions. And it's basically the same thing when you're on the court. When you are under that much pressure, that much stress, that much emotion on the court, which everybody is at times, you cannot think straight. So you think that hitting an underarm serve at this particular stage in the match is a good idea. And as soon as you hit it, you realise that was a terrible idea. This is not an appropriate time to be doing it. And, you know, or as I say, you change that into something a little bit more simple of just like slapping a second serve return down the line for a winner because you think I can do that, and then you realize actually that isn't, like, just thinking about it, if I had just taken a bit more time to think about it, that is not a sensible thing to do. You've also got to manage your heart rate, because when your heart rate gets high and stays high, you genuinely have less oxygen in the brain, makes it more difficult to think clearly as well. So that's often when you see the end of a really, really long point when everybody's gassed, and then the one player has that really easy finish and they just do something dumb. And it's just, there's no oxygen in the brain there. That's just a complete shutdown. So that's what we mean when we talk about these pressure situations. It's stress. You know, when you're under that much stress, people don't think straight, even the very best in the world. And well, the very best in the world are better at doing that than others. Bublik, I don't know if it's stress. I'm not sure. I mean, I've been watching him for a number of years now, and I just wonder whether he's actually that competitive. I just wonder whether I don't think he's that bothered if he then went on to lose that match in Metz. I think he probably would think about it afterwards and be like, oh, I would have rather won it. But I don't know if it's stress. It could be a defense mechanism before it gets stressful. So sometimes people do that. They'll start going, I can't do it, because they don't want to put themselves in that situation. I can't just play properly. I'm going to do this. And he has a real tendency on really big points to do really stupid stuff. That's what he does. But yeah, I just wonder whether he just is entertaining himself. It's difficult, isn't it? It's difficult. Because somebody like Kyrgios, he never said, until this year, he never said, I really want to do it and I want to do my best. But he's done that this year, and now he is doing his best, which is turns out to be pretty good, as most people were expecting. But for Bublik, I think maybe he's in the same situation. I don't think he has said, I want to be the best I can be. There's always an assumption from everybody outside of the world of tennis, all of the journalists, all of the media that I speak to. They always assume that every single person in the top 100 is trying to be the best they can possibly be, and it's just not the case. And I just don't think that Bublik is one of them. I don't think he wants to be the best he can be at the moment. That might change, like we've seen with Kyrgios. But at the moment, I think he just wants to be doing enough, making a good living, having a nice life, having some fun on the court. I don't know, is that harsh?
And again, there's nothing wrong with that, because we've had conversations before and I've said to you, why wouldn't you want to be the very best and get everything out of you? And you're like, you know, if you're in the top 50, the top 100, you're getting into all the Grand Slams, you're making a really good living, maybe that was your goal. Not everybody will have the goal of being number one and will put that effort in. So and I think fairly recently he became a dad, I believe, Bublik, to a little boy. That can and cannot change people's way of thinking, but he's making a good look. He just feels he might not care, but when it's a final, you think, I would think logically, I've done all that work to get to the final. So if I can just focus for this final, you know, you win the title and that's lovely. I don't know. There's that logic bit would think.
I see what you mean, because you're there until the end of the ceremony anyway. So you're not, the option of sort of bailing out and going home isn't really there, because you've got, you're there. Yeah.
You've done all that. Yeah. You've been there a week. You've got there. You've obviously had to put hard work in at times. It wasn't all a breeze to get there. So you focused at some point. So why not? But is it a defense mechanism of, he's down a bit, thinks he's going to lose, so then just self-destructs.
If anyone's not seen it, I mean, he hit the ball with the grip of his racket. He turned the racket around, hit it with the grip of his racket, which I watched him do not that long ago. I cannot remember which tournament it was. It might have been Indian Wells or Miami. And he won the point.
Miami, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was
Yeah.
But I think he won the point there. So, look, this time it was in a final and he lost the point. You know, it's obviously not really that bothered. So, yeah, I don't know. I see what you mean, that you're in the final, like you've done all of the hard work. Yeah. Now it's just the match. Just play the match. See if you can win.
It's like a waste of a week. It feels like a waste of a week. You've gone there for a reason. So I don't know. It's just, it's different mindsets.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
So that was getting a lot of social media traction. Something else that was getting a lot of social media traction was Emma Raducanu, because she was doing really well in the Korean Open. Obviously, the ranking's gone down since the US Open. It's kind of settled in what the 70s, 80s it had. So still, there is still a lot of attention and focus on her. But what we saw again was a withdrawal in the semifinals against Yelena Ostapenko. So my question to you, as a non-athlete who now eats a lot of cinnamon swirls, is
a diet of 100% cinnamon swirl.
Oh, that would be amazing. Do we need to worry about the amount of injuries? When do we start to worry? Because initially people said she hadn't played a lot of tennis on tour. Now she's played a bit more. She's a little bit older. So where are we with, should we be worried? Is it just different? But like, where are you at with this?
I sort of bounce around with it, to be honest, because I think there are two ways of viewing it. You know, one, if we take all of the positives, you can say that, well, she's not picking up any serious injuries like other young players have done. Sophia Kenin, for example, completely derailed her career with a big injury. I'm sure it's not her fault. Bianca Andreescu, who pushed through injuries and, if we're being blunt about it, was quite immature, and her team didn't stop her from doing that. And that has massively derailed her career, hugely derailed her career. And it's going to take, whether she gets back on track, we don't even know yet. We'll have to see. So you could look at it and you can say, well, she's managing these injuries by pulling out of these matches. They're only ever very small injuries. She's often back on court within a few days practicing. That, you know, she's not pulling out and is out for a couple of months with tendonitis. You know, none of that. It's that she's trying to prevent, or you could see that she's trying to prevent these major injuries. And look, she hasn't had a major injury. She's had constant niggles, but she has not been in the situation of Andreescu, of Kenin, and there are others as well. So you can sort of say, well, she's doing a good job. She's still out there week in, week out. She's still playing. She's not really missing any tournaments because of it. She missed a bit of the grass court season. That was a real bummer for her. But again, that was only a couple of weeks. And she was, you know, healthy, fit and healthy and fine at Wimbledon, really. So, yeah. But then on the other side of things, it obviously is concerning if the only way to manage your body is to continue to pull out of tournaments. Because I think that was her fourth withdrawal in mid-match in the year. And it's, yeah... And then you sort of look at it from the other perspective, and it's not like she's that young. She's 20 in a month. So I recognise, obviously, when she won the US Open, she had literally not been on tour. She was not a tour player at all. So there was some ground to make up. But she's had a full year now of saying, I need to get stronger. I need to get the body right. I need to get used to this level. But it's a year now. So I think most players would be used to that, especially because she's turning 20 soon. So your body's mature, you know, you're sort of at that stage. So I don't know, some days I get frustrated. Just as an Emma fan, obviously, I was thinking, okay, right, the pressure's been released now from the US Open because the ranking's down where it should be. You know, we were just waiting for that to happen. And then she started winning matches in Seoul, and it was, I sort of thought, okay, right, here we go. Now she can play properly. Now she can actually get on with business. And then she got stopped there at that semi-final and had to pull out. And then you just think, oh, can't you just finish the match? Because there's another school of thought. There's one element of protecting your body, which is obviously the way that Emma is going. But a lot of other players, they think you need to toughen up your body. You need to get out there. You need to go through the battles. You need to really, you know, you need to feel fatigued. You need to feel like you're in a bit of pain. Your body needs to be used to that. It's sort of like... hard skin on your feet. You know, if you have a pedicure, like Marin Cilic will tell you, it's not good news.
Because baby, you're soft skin on your feet is not good.
You're too soft. You need to be sort of worn out a little bit. You need to be battle hardened to be ready to go. So, yeah, I don't know. It's difficult. As I say, like, being totally honest, I bounce around with it. And it's sort
of... is there a mental side to it? Could it... A fear of... I don't know what it is. A fear of... So is there a mental aspect to it, not just the body getting niggles?
Well,
is it a combination?
I thought there could have been a mental aspect to it last year because she was ranked number 10 in the world and she wasn't the 10th best player in the world. Like, you know, it was a very weird, inflated ranking, all completely valid and earned by her. But it just didn't match her game style. So I could understand that mentally she would feel quite fragile, quite vulnerable. But I did feel like, oh, after US Open and then she started winning matches in Seoul, I was thinking, oh, okay, right, here we go. Everything that all that has been released. So I'm not sure whether it's mental or whether it's just that's the approach. The approach is I will not let myself get a serious injury and I will do anything it takes to prevent that from happening. But the problem is that every single tennis player will tell you that you do not play a week on tour without some sort of niggle. Everybody does. So if that is her mentality, then she will just continue to pull out quite frequently because, you know, that's life on tour.
You're right, isn't it? Do you take a big chunk of time off? Can you afford to at her age, her stage? Or do you just plough on through and play lots of matches? I do want to say at this point, because we did talk about Roger Federer, I'm now bouncing around, that... Evan, who I mentioned last week, called him Ethan, so apologies, Evan. The Roger Federer memorabilia can still be bid for. It's all in aid of a fabulous mental health charity that they set up in memory of their son, who they lost through suicide. I'm going to repost the link, but that's still out there and people can bid on that. So, Evan, sorry about the name. Honestly, it's sort of old age and not working. It's crazy, isn't it? It all falls to pieces.
His brain's turned to mush.
My brain is turned to mush. I can say I've got baby brain, but my twins are now quite a few years. Yeah, no.
I've still got baby brain. I mean, Roger will be two in a couple of months.
Oh, you can definitely keep baby brain. I think I kept it. I think with twins, I pushed. I think you keep it to two probably is acceptable.
Okay,
I got it to three. But I think mine are what now? Seven. So it's probably stretching it a little bit. Something I want to talk about. This is real heart pull on the heartstrings is Juan Martín Del Potro.
Oh, don't do it to me.
Oh, I tell you.
I honestly don't think I can. You're going to have to talk about this. I can't do it.
It's just, oh, this man's story is heartbreaking. Everything with Roger Federer was very sad and we saw the tears and it was the knee that ultimately led to his retirement, but he was 41, what he'd achieved. He'd had a while to get used to it, although I know saying it out loud is different, et cetera, et cetera. But Juan Martín Del Potro recently did an article, was it with a Spanish or South American publication, just talking about the loss of tennis and just being this massive hole in this void of everything he could have been. 2009 US Open champion. It's 2009.
Yeah, and I think wasn't he like 19 when he won?
Yeah, and then immediately the injuries, and it wasn't just the wrists that he's battled back from, but he's had two fractured kneecaps. Who has one? He has two, and he said he's despite the fact he tried this year, played a match, then said goodbye. He has pain walking upstairs. He can't run. He can't. He's still trying to find solutions. He's still trying to go to doctors. He's still trying to get answers. And he just feels so lost without tennis. I mean, what more does that fella have to go through?
It's difficult, isn't it? I don't think he was 19, actually. I think he might have been 21 or something like that. 21, 22.
But he had the whole tennis career ahead of him.
Yeah.
At that stage.
And the thing is that no one... No one remembers what doesn't happen, right? It doesn't matter what the reason is. It doesn't matter what the reason is that you're not on tour. You know, and people forget. They forget how good he was. He would have genuinely been a consistent part of the Big Four, would have been Big Five. And 100%. I would have loved to have seen if he could have really infiltrated that Big Three. He could have with the way that he played. I remember watching him in Rome when he came back from, I think it was his second injury off, and he came, like, he just flew up to the top of the sport every single time. I mean, the forehand is the biggest around. It's there's nothing on tour right now that even touches how big his forehand is. Like, just there's no one.
No.
His forehand would get gasps from the crowd all the time. Always go and watch the video of the biggest Del Potro forehands. It's the best video on YouTube, I think, hands down. I love it. And, I was talking about about it to somebody else the other day. It wasn't about Juan Martín. It was about Monica Seles and how people forget how much of a phenomenon she was because the career got cut short. But, you know, she had... Oh, I'm going to mess up the numbers here, but I think she'd won, what, eight or nine slams as a teenager. It was absolutely bonkers. She won, like, 9 out of 11 slams. It was just... an extraordinary,
it's unbelievable,
an extraordinary unbelievable. Situation. And I mean, you talk about Serena's 23. I mean, she would have been up there, possibly more than that. But shoulda, woulda, coulda. It's just unfortunately sometimes, yeah, life gets in the way, doesn't it? And it sort of pushes back. It resists these things. So yeah, people forget. And then what happened? You know, Sellers was there. Ready for a rivalry with Steffi Graf. You say rivalry, she might have actually just dominated her. It might have been like a Serena and Maria Sharapova rivalry that wasn't really a rivalry. It was just very one-sided. You don't know. Completely. And then Graf went on to get the Golden Slam and to do all of these things and have this fabulous career. And we all talk about Graf because of what she's achieved. It's just, yeah, it sucks. It sucks. And I will watch that video of Del Potro's biggest forehands tonight.
But I thought it was interesting. When I brought up Del Potro, you said, you're going to have to talk about it. I can't. And then you managed to talk about Monica Seles instead of Del Potro. I can't talk about it. No, it's, you
because
know.
Because he's been one of my favourites.
Of my whole life in tennis,
one of my favourites. So obviously no one touches Andy, but that's because Andy's Andy. He's British and, you know, I've been around him since I was tiny. But... Juan Martín.
We can't end on this note. We can't end on the point. You look like you're about to burst into tears.
Well, why don't we should end on it, and I'll go and watch that video, and then I'll feel better.
You're going to go and watch the video. And finally, can you just give me one piece of advice? Boys are off to tennis today. One of the twins is determined now. That's his sport. He's going to do it. I need to give him a bit of advice because he's so keen. He's only little. He's the smaller one. But he puts everything, he wallops everything. And how do I tell him? The coach is really good, and he's really good with his coordination, but he just hits everything like it's the last ball he's ever going to hit. How do I tell him he doesn't need to? What words can I put to a seven-year-old that... Ooh, I mean, just have fun.
It's a tough one with the kids, though, because, you know, we've got a zone that you've got to try and hit. That's the thing. It's all about scoring points, the amount of times you hit the zone. That's other sports. There are other sports.
I think he thinks he's got to leather it for it to be good. I'm like, just a little bit off that ball. While his brother, who's a team sport man, he's kind of doing the downward dog on the side, spinning his racket. You know, he's kind of, I'm like, okay, there's no focus. So I've got one who's doing sort of weird downward dog things in the corner of the court and the other one like leathering the ball. I'm like, all right, boys, you have fun. So,
He is having fun and he's just decided this is what he wants to be his sport. So I say let him go with it for a little bit and then he'll start to realise that he needs to get the ball in at times. It took me about 10 years to realise that.
Did it? Marvellous. All right. Nothing to worry about then. We've got time.
My coach used to always say to me, when I was little, when I was probably like 8 or 9, we used to go in, you have like a caged court. So it's just a single court with fence all around it. So it's called a cage thing. And he always said to me that we would end up, we'd go out of the gate and have to go and pick up the balls from outside of the cage. There were more balls outside the cage than there were in the cage, let alone hitting the court. I had no chance.
That is a lovely, happy thought to leave it on. We will be back with more next week. How about that?
Yeah. Good luck on the tennis.
Thank you very much. Bye. Enjoy the video.